Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me, let's fly away.
So this is Ann Dalton with Sun Sounds, and this program is called Are We There Yet? Today, we are going to hear about an eco-conscious adventure through the Scottish Highlands. Ecotourism is booming in the Scottish Highlands, and its wealth of sustainable experiences celebrates the region's rich biodiversity and unsung heroes of the land. This article is by Mike McEachern, and it is out of National Geographic. On the grassy meadows of Achenera Farm, not far from Oban in Argyll, Scotland, a herd of sodden-haired Highland cattle are sheltering from persistent rain under an oak tree. Heads tilt and horns shake, a warning to approach carefully. Few signs of the Atlantic temperate forest that once dominated the coastal glens of the West Highland seaboard remain. Now the ground is overtaken by invasive rushes and brackens, and the cattle stare, unmoved and ambivalent, chomping grass and watching our every step. One heifer in particular scows haughtily, regarding us with contempt. Don't turn your back, I'd been told. No sudden movements. That's Daisy, whispers cattle farmer Jane Isaacson, as we creep to within a horn's breadth. Her full pedigree name is Useg Ninth of the Island Moor, and next to her, that's Ban, or Bannerack Ban of Achenrare, and her calf, Bannerack Brig Third of Achenrare, from Jacques XVII of Woodnook. In the next field, I'm told, there's also the Glasteg of Rosenbaum line and the Moreg of Rosenbaum line. Both are bred by my Uncle Alan over in Modart. Let's go and say hello. Instead of being used like most herds, the 18-strong group of cattle on Achenrare Farm are carving out a different existence, providing the UK's first Highland cow well-being experience. The idea, Jane explains, is to walk with the cattle, watch them for a while, and learn how they're helping rewild this 132-acre regenerative farm near Barkaldine. That might be the world's oldest recorded breed of cattle, long registered by bloodline with wonderfully honorific titles, but you can almost feel that they're part of a new energy. The presence of that Highland fold is partly due to a shift in the attitudes across Argyll and the Highlands. Slow travel and sustainable tourism are reshaping this part of Scotland, and I'm here to learn more about it firsthand from a variety of entrepreneurs and environmentalists. Once, you had to look hard for evidence of green tourism, and now there are new ways to discover this ancient landscape with many experiences offering a better sense of connection with the land in its purest state. Frankly, it's all about big trips with small footprints. As we pick our way through the field, I learn the fold's grazing habits prevent overgrowth, encouraging natural regeneration by reducing the prevalence of more vigorous plants. In between times, their milk is also used for what's believed to be the world's only Highland cow ice cream, a sustainably minded product that's now putting this unsung community on the food map. It's a mini farming evolution, but one with added tutti frutti. Walking, whispering, squelching, Jane opens the fence to another pasture. We slip out into a second field overlooking Loch Creran and ringed by nettles and meadowsweet. Where the ground is rough and steep, a burn flows clear. In the next field, ponies raise their heads under Douglas firs in the next field. There's a rare stillness here of birdsong and river rush, and the sensation is of the body and mind opening up to life on the farm. Life's too fast these days, don't you think? Asks Jane. People come here to experience a sort of inner peace. Highland Fold is not the only pioneer of green tourism in the area. A road trip by electric car provides numerous opportunities to explore the region and enjoy plenty more sustainable experiences. The day after my visit, I find myself a short drive away on the Apen Coast, where I meet Michael Lethley from the Pier House Hotel. He's pulling in lobster-filled krill traps right from the lock side in his chef's whites, meters from his waterfront kitchen. It's high tide when I arrive, and I watch him scramble along the rocky shore with silhouetted castle stalker reflecting moodily on the lock's surface in the distance. The air smells of algae and gulls squawk before taking flight. The biggest difference with what we do is having boots on the ground, he explains. I meet all the foresters, farmers, and fishermen, and I know how the seasons, the land, and sea work for them and for me. Lockyer is my giant lobster tank, and there's not many chefs that can say that. Ask Michael today, and he'll tell you sustainability is all he thinks about. It's become a gut instinct. What makes Argyll unique is the symbiotic relationships that exist. Everyone supports each other, and there's a real mindfulness about where our food is sourced, he says. We're not thinking in terms of our lifetime either, but what the impact will be for this community 100 years' time. Inside the hotel, I'm presented with the day's sustainable pickings. Oysters and sugar kelp mignonette, garlicky langoustines, a lobster on the half shell. Seafood restaurants from London to Edinburgh brag that produce is locally sourced, but what arrives at my table is mere meters from the brine and barnacles. No seabeds have been dredged, no ecosystems disturbed. The krill-baited langoustines are lured by local fisherman Egan Black off the coast of Lismore, while oysters are hand-harvested by Judith Vack, who runs Caledonian Oyster Company on Loch Craren. Dessert to follow is natural ice cream from the Highland Fold. The feeling is more time and effort has been put in and at lower environmental cost. I'd like to imagine everyone in the community has bought into the deal. Eco Adventures can take travelers even deeper into the Highlands, and this is where the road leads me next. It's only recently that tourists have started to venture into the River Glens surrounding Loch Ness. Whereas previously, access to the land was restricted by private shooting lodges offering members the chance to bag a stag or grouse. These vast estates are dwindling in number, replaced by sustainable tourism initiatives looking to shift perspectives. One of the most impressive projects in the Dundrigan Rewilding Center in Glenmoriston, the world's first visitor campus of its kind, nestled in a vibrant corner of the Highlands. This center aims to address the climate crisis and combat biodiversity loss, taking travelers along for the ride by offering in-depth tours of the grounds. For me, this is the essence of elemental ecotourism cranked up to 11. Pine marten amid silver birch and juniper trees stretch their legs in the sun. Osprey spread on montane grasses in a golden eagle perches on a Scots pine. Swallows, chaffinches, missel thrushes, sparrowhawks, pipe strellers, and brown long-eared bats have all made homes in this cloak of woodlands. Life is returning, and the vibe is David Attenborough meets Narnia. Dundrigan, where I join a morning 4x4 safari, was once the site of a 14th-century royal hunting ground. Its healthy population of game helped it prosper during the height of Victorian-era country sports, But where a denuded landscape of open hills was once an advantage, it now makes the area vulnerable. An overabundance of red and roe deer is a common problem throughout the highlands, and the negative impact they're having on the landscape is profound. Existing woodland is critically damaged, and new trees often struggle to grow, upsetting the ecological balance. But for all this lack of harmony, hope has returned. The Dundrigan Rewilding Center has acquired by a nonprofit Trees for Life in 2008 as part of the Landscape Scale Africa Highlands Vision. This 30-year plan is designed to rewild the areas of Glens Morriston, Afric, Kennick, and Sheil, transforming them into sanctuaries where nature can thrive. Now, nearly 2 million native trees have been planted across the 10,000-acre landscape, and the on-site nursery is delivering up to 100,000 extra trees every year. It's time and effort well spent, I think, and a good place to be a mountain hare, migratory bird, or butterfly. By limiting deer numbers, our plan is proving effective. We can now see trees flourishing all the way up the hillside, explains guide Stephen Cooling, a devotee of the Glen who now spearheads volunteerism weeks. Part of the rewilding story is to be good neighbors and engage the local community, but also bring people along with us on the journey. It's about connecting hearts and minds. We bump across the hills in the late morning gloom, anticipating the next thump before Stephen brings the 4x4 to an abrupt stop on a ridge overlooking the glen. Below is silvery Loch Cluny, and then down through northern slopes of pine forest, Glen Afric appears. I survey the landscape. There are plenty of areas left for common grazing where trees won't be planted, but lark, pine, and birch are taking root. From the corner of my eye, I catch a golden eagle spiraling in the thermals. An unusual bubbling call catches in the air. "That's the black grouse," says Stephen. "It's lekking season, so they're up here somewhere." This behavior is rarely glimpsed by visitors, but those who witness it are treated to the sight of agile males performing elaborate courtship rituals, reminiscent of Strictly Come Dancing routines as they waltz for potential mates. There are rumors, too, that there are numerous feral pigs, but I see no signs. The afternoon wearing on, we return to the visitor center where I'm shown a Gaelic map of the area covered in place names that reference features of the natural landscape. There's Crig Amadad, the Hill of the Wolf, and Crig Bithi, Hill of the Birch, and also Crig Anfiron, Crag of the Golden Eagle, Carn Nan Erb, Hill of the Roses, and Ult Nan Gobar, Burn of the Goats. These are the names the ancient Gaels gave Glen Morriston's landscapes, and there's something everlasting in that, because it strikes me that what was once forgotten is now being welcomed back again. There are deeply rooted stories here, and the wrongs of the past are being challenged. There are reflections, too. They can be found in the lochs, burns, and streams, and each one is a mirror to remind us about the world we live in and what we choose to make it. Our next story is a definite change of pace and location, a culinary tour of Kansas City, the Midwestern city where food is ruled by flame. Brisket, burnt ends, and an anything-goes spirit define barbecue culture in KC, a Midwestern U.S. city with a voracious appetite for all things smoked, charred, and flame-grilled. This article is by James Marklin from National Geographic magazine. In the space of 10 minutes, what was a small scattering of people outside Chef J. Barbecue has become a sizable cue. Under an azure dome of Midwest sky, the November air is crisp in Kansas City's West Bottoms neighborhood as midday approaches. There's no obvious restaurant signage here, save for a faded pallet leaning against a wall with white painted lettering on each scratched plank, advertising beef, brisket, turkey, pork ribs, burnt ends. The doors open and we're beckoned up the creaking wooden stairs of Chef Jay's old red brick townhouse. Inside, a large chalkboard hanging above a counter flanked by pillars of corrugated iron advertises an array of cuts, sandwiches and sides. An intense whiff of smoke and meat emanates from the kitchen behind. "I'm a rough-around-the-edges kind of guy," says owner and pitmaster Justin J. Easterwood, looking proudly around the restaurant he opened in 2020. "I don't like new and shiny stuff," he says. Wearing a dull green sweater with brown hair tied back into a ponytail and red tattoos dancing up his right arm, Justin has been a devotee of the flame since his teens. Now, years later, a monstrous 1,000-gallon smoker sits outside his restaurant like a submarine in a dry dock, burning all night long. He cooks as many slabs of fresh brisket as possible for the next day, and once it's gone, it's gone. "There's something to be said about cooking over fire," Justin tells me. "You have to adjust to what it's doing. It's not just a question of turning on a burner or setting the oven to high. That fire dictates what's going on flavor-wise. You got to respect the fire. It really is like a living, breathing thing," he says. And from those crackling embers, Justin presents me with a slice of fatty brisket, caramelized ribs with a sweet glaze and some delicate pork belly burnt ends. Burnt ends, a Kansas City barbecue staple, are usually taken from beef brisket, but Justin prefers pork. They're soft, sweet, and with a light kick from the peppery rub. Biting into the brisket, any toughness soon falls away into a buttery, salted nirvana. Justin tends to eschew the thick, sticky, molasses-heavy sauces that Kansas City barbecue is also known for, preferring to let the meat's natural flavors shine through. But this is a city that's always played a little fast and loose with the rules. Straddling the state line between Missouri and Kansas, the city they call KC sits right in the heart of America's Midwest. In the 19th century, it was a vital trading post and crossroads on the Missouri River. When Prohibition arrived in the 1920s, Kansas City developed a lawless reputation under mob boss Tom Pendergast, and its speakeasies attracted celebrities, politicians, misfits, and musicians, all looking to get their kicks away from the prying eyes of the law. Much of this activity took place at the smoke-filled jazz clubs and drinking dens along 18th and Vine, a largely African-American neighborhood where Henry Perry, a few years earlier, had begun barbecuing an outdoor pit by an old streetcar barn. Serving diced cuts of smoked meat wrapped in newspaper, Henry's style of cooking caught on and eventually led to the opening of the iconic Arthur Bryan's Barbecue on the same spot in 1949, whose guests have since included the likes of Jack Nicholson and Barack Obama. Almost a century after the so-called father of Kansas City barbecue began serving smoked meats, there are more than 100 barbecue restaurants scattered across KC. It's likely that the free-willing nature of the city's past allowed it to be more laissez-faire with its definition of barbecue, too. To put it simply, these days pretty much anything goes. Smokehouses across Texas traditionally fire up beef briskets that are light on sauces or marinades, while over in the Carolinas you'll find pork shoulder, pulled pork, and whole hogs coated in thinner vinegar marinades or spicy mustard sauces. But in Kansas, everything is on the table and everyone is invited to the party, especially newcomers. Opened in 2014 in Midtown, Q39's exposed brick walls host sepia photos, newspaper clippings, sauce jars for sale, and trophies won by its late founder and local barbecue legend, Rob McGee. TVs line the space above the bar, though few customers pay attention to them, instead metronomically lifting their heads between food and conversation. I'd led kitchens, I'd opened hotels, but I'd never run a barbecue restaurant before, says executive chef Philip Thompson about his journey to Q39 as we sit at a table near the bar. For a cuisine so quintessentially American, it's a surreal experience to be talking with a fellow Brit as he explains in a mid-Atlantic drawl how he became a barbecue convert. Wide-eyed and raising his hands for emphasis when speaking, Philip tells me he's lived in the U.S. for almost 20 years and displays a student-like reverence for the world he's adopted. Burnt ends is what KC barbecue is all about, he says, slicing off a crispy end of brisket during a meandering tour through Q39's warren of kitchen corridors where huge smokers burn hickory wood for up to 16 hours at a time. I chew slowly to savor every last second of this heavenly square, where the charred ends contrast deliriously well with the succulent pink interior, and I can see why Philip playfully refers to them as meat marshmallows. Amazingly, such was the disdain with which burnt ends were treated during the barbecue's infancy, they were once handed out for free at counters while orders were taken. At the time, they were called burnt edges, Philip explains. After a while, the chefs realized that this part of the brisket has a really nice marbling of fat, so they'd separated that from the brisket, dice it into cubes, and call it burnt ends. Back at the table, I'm treated to some tender pork belly, a thicker, juicier cut of brisket, and some magnificent chicken wings tossed in chipotle, barbecue sauce, and grilled for extra caramelization. I'm being bludgeoned by barbecue in its most naked form, but this town, especially in old-school joints like Gates Barbecue and Arthur Bryant's, also loves throwing its finest cuts into overflowing sauce-laden sandwiches. A 10-minute drive from here, deeper in Casey's suburban sprawl, is a place serving arguably the city's most unusual barbecue in bread. In its car park, the glare of the bright Midwest sun makes it hard to read any of the vehicle's number plates, so I need to squint a little, but my eyes don't deceive me. There are several California and Louisiana plates alongside with a usual flurry of pale blue Kansas ones. Central California is around a 1,700-mile drive, so the sloping parking lot at Joe's Kansas City Barbecue is the first indication of the sort of dedicated pilgrims the place attracts. Back in 2005, Anthony Bourdain, the late chef and TV presenter, brought national attention to this mint-green intersection joint, which doubles as a petrol station. Oh, he changed our whole business, put us on the map as a destination, a place to go, says Joe's director of marketing, Eric Tata, as we take a seat near a window and watch hawking SUVs rumble by on the nearby highway, while a lonesome country music song rings out of the mountain speakers above. There's a certain novelty appeal that comes with the convergence of a gas station and Bourdain's seal of approval. But this isn't the only reason folks from out of state visit. The Z-Man sandwich is another. I tell Eric I'm not leaving without trying the legendary sandwich. Named after local radio DJ Mike Zarek, the Z-Man, who visited relentlessly, always asking for a brisket sandwich topped with melted cheese and two onions. Oh my God, cholesterol city. He just kept ordering it, explains Eric. So they had a competition to name the sandwich, and nothing stuck more than Z-Man. It just became a hit. The Z-Man is smaller than I expect, but after the first bite, I can see why they sell over 200 a day. The onion rings blend perfectly with the thinner cuts of smoky brisket sliced especially for this, while the texture is gloriously softened by melted cheese inside a buttered and toasted Kaiser roll. Not only is this the best thing I've eaten in KC, the grab-and-go sandwich is also one of the best entry-level items for anyone interested in exploring barbecue culture. In this laid-back, anything-goes barbecue town, there really is only one rule. Arrive with a voracious appetite. That's the end of our stories for today. Here's a bit of wit and wisdom. This quote from Harry S. Truman, quoted in Independent Australia. My choice early in life was either to be a piano player in a whorehouse or a politician. And to tell you the truth, there's hardly any difference. And this one from Martin Luther King Jr., quoted in The Knowledge, in the end we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And lastly, from Leo Tolstoy, quoted in To the Contrary, wrong does not cease to be wrong because the majority share in it. I hope you'll tune in next week to see where else we might venture. So this is Ann Dalton with Sun Sounds Tucson. Tune in with us next week for the next journey.
Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Information and Audio, then under Program Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to SunSounds podcasts on your Echo Dot or other smartphone devices.